Spinoza and so forth, called body and mind one in the life of the absolute. This is Dr. Herbert L. Barley, Dean of the University of Healing here in Campo, California, bringing you Absolute Philosopher. Spinoza called body and mind one in the life of the absolute. How does this function, one in the body of the absolute? How does it function that body and mind are one? Well, in absolute, there is no body, there is no life, there's only isness. And isness is allness. So, Spinoza, by referring to body and mind as being one in the life of absolute, was sort of talking about a very interesting topic. Because when you consider that body and mind are one in the relative world, and that there is no life in absolute, there is no life, there is no life, there is no death. There is no beginning, there is no end. There is only the allness. We fall into a lot of interesting traps here, a lot of interesting concepts where we are told that many things happen and many things take place. It's wise for us to consider this because Spinoza was a great philosopher and he called body and mind one in the life of the absolute. And he had a reason for doing that because Spinoza was a very pragmatic thinker. He thought of ideas that were consistent with reality, consistent with human thinking. And of course, the only way to describe what's going on in your world is to think about it in relation to something you know. And the only thing that we know is our human life. And so we try to defragment the absolute into an understanding on the relative level. And as long as we try to do that, we are falling into a great trap. And the great trap is that there can be no definition, there can be no way of defining absolute in relative terms. Although we try, we have a lot of fun playing the game. But nonetheless, in reality, there is no comparison. In reality, there is no relative in absolute. You see, we have spoken these thoughts before often and said, if we are aware of the relative, we are not aware of absolute. And if we are aware of absolute, we are not aware of relative. So how can the two ever be describable? When you are in absolute, the relative doesn't exist. And when you're in relative, absolute doesn't exist. It exists in fact, except that it does not exist in your understanding. And our biggest problem in dealing with this is we try to make it make sense. We try to make it make an understanding. I have written three books now. I'm finishing the third one on the absolute, the relative absolute, and the relative. Now, my relative book went across just wonderful. Everybody thought it was just great. My relative absolute book went across just wonderful. Everybody thought it was just super. And when I started writing about absolute, there were no words. There were no words. I've only gotten some 18 chapters or 15 chapters into it, and you run out of steam saying nothing, you know, and convoluting ideas where there is no convolution, where there is no confusion. But we try to confuse it by trying to give understanding to that which has no relative understanding. It has absolute understanding, but not relative understanding. And when I point it out in relative terms, people say, oh, that's a bunch of gobbledygook. That's a bunch of nonsense that cannot be described, cannot be understood, cannot be thought about. But I still play the game. When I was at the University of Chicago, we would sit with the professors in the philosophy department, and we would discuss with them in the evening in the president's house, Mr. Hutchins, and there were several of us students who were invited to come, either because we were so stupid or because we were so brilliant. We never did figure out which was the reason. And we were asked to be part of their discussion, part of their thinking. Now, what they were doing, they were probing our innocent minds. They were probing our naive consciousness. They were probing our simplistic way of thinking. And because of that, they were able to come up with some remarkable lectures on absolute. And the lectures were only based upon our simplistic thinking, on our innocence and our naivete. And I always thought it was really deep stuff. I read the lectures and I heard the lectures at the University of Chicago. And as I heard them, I thought to myself, what brilliant men, what brilliant geniuses they are. But then in afterthought, I began to think about what our discussions had been the night before. They gave their grand lectures, and their grand lectures were based upon the simplistic thinking that we had because we didn't know the answer. And because we didn't know the answer, we were able to play games with it. We were able to sort of imagine it and think about it in a very simple way and in a very innocent way. And, you know, sometimes that is the very answer that fulfills the convoluted thinking of the great philosophers and the great scientists and the great minds of all ages. I delight in reading the works of St. Augustine. You say, well, he's a Catholic. What are you reading him for? He was a great mind. He was able to think in these convoluted terms in a very positive and a very spiritually illuminating way. He did have some very strict attitudes about how we should live and how we should think, but that was all relative. And when you let the relative go and you moved into his absolute thinking, he was fabulous. He was fabulous. Unlimited, unlimited. And St. Thomas Aquinas. St. Thomas Aquinas was a contemporary there, and his writing was most penetrating. But you see, St. Thomas Aquinas had a problem that none of the other philosophers at that moment had. And St. Thomas Aquinas was a great musician and mathematician. And because he was a great musician and mathematician, he was able to drive right to the core of the concept absolute, which has no basis in human relativity, but only basis in science, in math, in music. And of course, all music is based on math. And all math is based on music. How wise we are if we are introduced to music early in life. If we can inculcate our minds in the field of music, in the field of magic, in the field of wonderment early in our life, because then we can hear these ideas on absolute, and they don't make a lot of nonsense. They begin to make sense. Cassius Clay says, what you sees, you is. You know. And so, are we what we see? Are we the is that we see? And yes, we are. Yes, we are. When you enter into the level of consciousness where you are into your highest and most supreme attitude of divinity, of absolute self, do you know what you're doing? You are flowing like a great river. You are feeling no pain. You are, there's nothing to solve. There's only to be. To be, to be, to be, to be, to be. Only be yourself and have fun. The very essence of what we teach here in the University of Healing. Be yourself and have fun. Live in your divine inner self. Jesus said, man, know thyself. Socrates said, man, know thyself. Plato said, man know thyself. Jesus said, it is done unto you according to your belief. And Jesus said, it is the Father within who has the answer. You see, so when we merge with that divine self that's within us, when we merge by not being separate, by not fighting it, we enter into a stillness, an awareness, an isness that is utterly unbelievable. On campus here, I tell the students as often as they protest, I say, don't protest. Flow with it. Play the game. Play the game. Play the game. When St. Augustine wrote The City of God, he played the game. He just, and just wrote about it and had a wonderful time. Now, who was there to say he was wrong? Who was there to say he was right? He listened to his, he could have written his own Bible. And The City of God was indeed part of his own Bible. Now, You take the great Marcus Aurelius, and as you listen to the writings of Marcus Aurelius and read the writings of Marcus Aurelius, he was a brilliant man, but he was down to earth. He was right down to the fundamental thinking. Yet, he was the foundation of education in all of Rome. From his foundation, he required that all Roman citizens and slaves be educated equally. Now, wow, that may not sound like an absolute concept or some way out concept, but it was a way in concept. It was so beautiful, so complete, so wonderful, because it opened the door for every human being on the face of the earth who came out of the Roman culture to move into an awareness of themselves. But you see, their problem, and it wasn't a problem, their problem was they gave over the power to the slaves. And in giving over the power to the slaves, they gave up the power of ruling themselves. And really, we should not belittle them. Because in giving up the power to the slaves, they took on the power of being themselves and having fun. Did you ever hear anything negative about the Roman nation when the slaves had taken over? No. There's the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. We might rather word that the revision and uplifting of the Roman Empire was when the Romans gave away all responsibility and to the outer and listened to the inner. Now, perhaps they all didn't listen to the inner, but they were on the road to it. They were on the way to it. And subsequent Roman cultures and empires proved that to be very true. Think about it. It's only when you stop being human and start being divine. You stop being human and let go and let the divine in you shine. When you are yourself and have fun, yourself, whoever that self may be, and have fun, the magic of who you are shines forth. And then, like Spinoza called the body and mind one in the life of the Absolute, though he had many phrases that don't fit in today's understanding of Absolute, he was moving toward it, and he was having fun. And you know, if you ever have the time to read the life of Spinoza and the teachings of Spinoza, the philosophy of Spinoza, not the teachings, but the philosophy of Spinoza, you'll find that he was a man who was being himself and having fun. Oh, he may have looked very serious, but inside he was giggling all the way. And that's what we want to do. We want to giggle all the way, like our dear beloved Anita, always giggling, always happy, always recognizing the joy of living and recognizing it now. And you know, we talk about Gertrude. Gertrude Suter, she too has her own way of giggling. But she giggles in the idea of, so, soapy, I'm doing my thing. I'm doing my thing. And she's not available to do something she doesn't want to do. And we say to her, why are you doing all these things that you don't have to do? She says, I like it. And she does. Because whenever she doesn't like it, she's not available. And that is a genius at work. And we could all readily learn from that kind of genius. Yes, it is yours right now. Be yourself and have fun. Play the game and reap the harvest of being the master that you are right now. I love you, 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 I love you. If I haven't said it enough, I'll say it a million times more. I love you.